Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on seven days a week, I should say, here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on theistic evolution when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year, the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's 286,000 cubic miles of it. Now, for century after century and millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is all of this possible? We call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds, and then ride back to the head of the toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. In the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood, and its laws are fairly well comprehended, but modern science has just learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. Now, that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture, and this is one of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School. Now, if you'd like to know more about that, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free of charge. Free. You can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about theistic evolution, which led us to dinosaurs, which now led us to, did the dinosaurs live at the same time men lived? Last program, I said, yes, they did. Now, that's almost like farting in church. You tell some evolutionist that men and dinosaurs live contemporaneously, and they'll look at you with contempt. Well, you've got to be stupid. You've got to be mork for mork to believe such crazy nonsense. Well, you must believe the world is flat. I've been ridiculed a time or two. But I told you about a skeleton that used to be on display up at the Chicago Museum of Natural History, a 14-foot tall skeleton. It's not the only skeleton that I've read or seen historical reference to. But you're going to look a long ways before you ever find a giant skeleton. And this guy, you remember David and Goliath? Goliath. Well, Goliath was only 9 feet 6 inches tall. I say only 9 foot 6. You know, today, if you see a guy 7 foot, say, wow, that guy's a giant. Guinness Book of Records has a couple of guys that are 8 foot 6. So Goliath was only a foot taller than the most recent giant who lived not too long ago, back in the 70s. They don't live very long. They get giantism, you know, and it's an ailment, and they live to be about 30 years old, and they die. Goliath was 9 foot 6. Og, the king of Bashan, mentioned in the Bible by Moses, was 14 feet tall. Well, his bed was 14 feet. So to corroborate that, they had this 14-foot tall skeleton on display in the Chicago Museum of Natural History. Well, I didn't tell 1940. It's not there anymore. It's gone. Gone. Why is it gone? Because it doesn't fit with the theory of evolution. And anything that doesn't fit with the theory of evolution is simply removed. And then in the last program, I said, that's not science, that's indoctrination. That's just propaganda. That's what you hear in Russia, you know, when they tell you that they invented everything under the sun. And it's true, some Russians invented a couple of things, no doubt about it, but that doesn't mean that they invented everything, and that was their claim back in the 50s, anyway, when I was a kid. You know, they'd come out with some new claim, a Russian invented the airplane, a Russian invented roller skates, a Russian invented this or that. You know, after a while, it didn't take you very long to figure out, you know, that's just propaganda. And probably if you're living in the Ituri rainforest of the Belgian Congo and you're a 4-foot pygmy, and they come along and tell you it was a Russian that invented this, you'd probably believe it. But, you know, the rest of us had access to encyclopedias and other sources of information. And we didn't believe that crap. Maybe the average Russian did, but then, you know, the average Russian probably wasn't reading the Encyclopedia Britannica or Americana here in the United States. So what's between your ears got there at some point after you were born, didn't it? So when I come along and I say, well, listen, the dinosaurs and human beings lived at the same time. They were created by God. Adam and Eve were living in the garden with Tyrannosaurus Rex. And, you know, people look at them, well, you know, you must be mork for mork. Gordon, you're not with it. Well, depending upon how you were educated. I mean, I was educated in the same books you were. And one time I thought the same thing when I first heard somebody say dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time. I thought he was nuts. Difference is, I said, well, what evidence have you got of that? That's pretty important. You know, if that was really true, that would tend to corroborate the Bible, not evolutionary philosophy. I mean, they're the guys that are telling us that man didn't live with the dinosaurs, and that the dinosaurs all died out 65 million years before man got on the scene. Now, if that's true, well, then man and dinosaurs didn't live together. But if man and dinosaurs lived together, well, then the dinosaurs in 65 million years ago is a fiction. Now, you see, the two of them don't fit together, do they? So here's an update on human track-like features found with dinosaur tracks at Tuba City, Arizona, by Jeremy Aldenay. Again, this is citing from the Creation Conference, Twin Cities Creation Conference, 1992. These are the proceedings, and this is just one more article. And you can get this book, by the way, from Creation Evidences Museum, Glen Rose, Texas, G-L-E-N-R-O-S-E, Texas. You might send a letter to Dr. Carl Baugh. Carl Baugh and Creation Science Museum, Glen Rose, Texas, and what you're looking for is the Twin Cities Creation Conference, 1992. Now, they might have one from 2002, but I'm citing the one from Northwestern College, July 29th to August 1st, Twin Cities Creation Conference, 1992, and I got it from Glen Rose, Texas. This is the article on update on human track features found with dinosaur tracks at Tuba City, Arizona, by Jeremy Aldenay. Update on continuing research on the human-like fossil impressions found in the same strata near dinosaur tracks south of Tuba City, Arizona, presented by the Creation Research Society's Tuba City Project's paleontological researcher Jeremy Aldenay. This report will discuss the 53 quasi-human ichnofossils, human-like impressions in sedimentary rock, reported for the first time in 1989 in the Creation Research Society Quarterly, along with 40 new quasi-human ichnofossils discovered on a field trip June 21st through June 27th, 1990, which are still under research during the last 2 years. Also, for the first time, the discovery of clear, undisputed dinosaur trails, only a few meters from our humanoid impressions on Site 2 on a field trip in October 1990, along with its importance in proving that clear, barefoot human tracks were seen here in the past and its implications for, get this word now, paleo, crypto, anthro, podi, chronological research. Do you get that? I'm not going to count the letters in it, but it's about, I don't know, 20 or 30 letters long. That means the ancient, unexplained human track fossil study. God, only a PhD could write something like that, can he? Now, dinosaurs in the Bible. So let's take a look at dinosaurs in the Bible. The Bible refers to dinosaurs and all other land animals in Genesis 1, verse 24, where all of the first land animals and man were created together on Friday, the sixth day, further proven by God's statement in Job 40, verse 15, where it says, "Behold, now behemoth, which I made with thee." The description of this land animal matches only a dinosaur. It is interesting to look up the original meaning of the Hebrew words used in verse 21. "He lieth under the shady trees in the covert of the reed and fens." The word reed is calamus. Interesting, because calamite reeds are common fossils found with dinosaurs. You'll see that in McKee, 1982, page 97, and Camp, 1930, page 8. Also, where it says in verse 24, "He taketh it with his eyes, his nose pierceth through snares." This is describing a creature that comes up out of the river, so powerful that he feels he owns it, and he attracts people, or attacks people along the river, causing so much trouble that people set traps only to have him escape by using his nose. The description matches a sauropod dinosaur. There are identical reports from recent history from northern Rhodesia in Central Africa. In 1932, big game hunter F. Grobler of Cape Town, South Africa, reported to the press that a theropod-type dinosaur from his description, like a Tyrannosaurus rex, was seen by natives. It is known by the name of Chepiki or Chepiqui. The natives in Central Africa used to call it the water lion. It can best be described as a huge iguana, the weight of which is estimated at about 4 tons or more. It was discovered about 6 months ago by a German scientist in the Dilolo swamps in Angola, and while I was in that country, I saw photographs of it. I went to Lake Dilolo myself to look for it, but I didn't see one. The natives say it is extremely rare and seldom seen, but they're convinced, as I am, of its existence. It lives only in swamps, and from what I was told, it attacks rhinos, hippos, and elephants, reported by Hoovelmans, 1972, page 264. Alfred Aloysius Horn reports on a similar animal, possibly the same type in the Cameroons, called Jago Nini in the swamps and rivers. It comes out of the water and devours people. Old men will tell you that their grandfathers saw, or what they saw, but they still believe it's there. Same as the Amali, I've always taken it to be. I've seen Amali's footprint, about the size of a good-sized frying pan in circumference and three claws instead of five, reported in Hoovelman's 1972, page 265. When I found the first undisputed dinosaur tracks north of Site 2 at Tuba, Arizona, they consisted of faint, three-toed impressions and three clear claws. Now, Bernard Hoovelman, spelled H-E-U-V-E-L-M-A-N-S, describes a sauropod-type dinosaur from reports by natives and explorers. It's called Mokuli Mbimbi, and Issaquaquamadivu. Boy, those are African names if I ever saw them, and are no less alike, although one lives in the Cameroons and the other in northern Rhodesia, at least 1,200 miles apart. They both have a body almost the size of an elephant's, a long neck and powerful tail like a crocodile's, or a lizard's tail. The Issaquaquamadivu has a snake's head, and both it and the Badigu have a track about 5 feet, 152 centimeters wide. I would imagine that's their stride, not the footprint. Now, the only adornment on the three is the single tooth, which is presumably a horn. It may well be an inconspicuous bump or a feature peculiar to the male and might be missed by some of the witnesses, reported in Hoovelman's 1972, page 284. This bump may be the nose bump on the top of the sauropod called Brachiosaurus. It is interesting that when explorers come back from tropical jungle areas, which have a similar climate to the pre-flood world, as well as the climate that dinosaurs lived in, as indicated by the fossil record, Lockley, 1989, page 11, they report that natives describe and recognize certain types of dinosaurs, reported by Hoovelman, 1972, on page 261 through 288. And from these same areas, living fossil plants are found, which are also found in the same strata with dinosaur fossils. Now, I was talking about this subject when my friend Ed Bachner of Durango, Colorado, told me that he was in the Air Force, flying off the coast of Columbia, South America in the late 1960s, watching for smugglers' boats, and when he spotted a huge flying creature the size of a small plane gliding over the ocean far below. It had a long snout and a projection behind its head. It was only visible for a few moments before it disappeared back into the jungle. His description matches the creature seen by Sioux Indians before the white men arrived. They saw it, struck by lightning, and found its skeleton near Taylor in 1973. Or this was reported by Taylor in 1973. Their description matches the flying reptile Pterodon, P-T-E-R-O-D-O-N. Evidence indicates that most supposedly extinct animals and man coexisted in the past and in the present, Hoovelman's 1972. Dr. Clifford Burdick told me at a creation meeting in Orange County, California, 1970, that Errol Cummings had seen a glimpse of huge animals which looked like dinosaurs while flying over South America in his private plane, and that they planned to first locate Noah's Ark, then they would hunt for a live dinosaur. Dr. Samuel Hubbard's predictions at Tuba City. In 1924, Dr. Samuel Hubbard, curator of archaeology at the Oakland Museum in California, led the Doheny scientific expedition to study evidence that man and some extinct prehistoric animals had coexisted. He was accompanied by one of the top paleontologists of the time, Dr. Charles W. Gilmore, curator of vertebrate paleontology at the United States National Museum. This is reported in a book called Gilmore, 1926, and Hubbard, 1924. Worthy of note is the Holy Rhinoceros. I guess it's the Woolly, W-O-O-L-L-Y. Note is the Woolly Rhinoceros. It's a pictograph that they examined near Moab, Utah. They assumed that it was an ancient drawing. However, there are pictographs made by ancient Anasazi Indians here, and in France there is an accepted pictograph of a woolly rhinoceros in a cave at Font du Goum in the Dordogne, and that's reported in Hoovelman's 1965, page 203. And other pictographs and artifacts have proven that man did exist with mastodons, mammoths, and ground sloths. Now, while on the Doheny expedition in 1924, they stopped at Tuba City to study the dinosaur tracks. Their pictures match the tracks photographed and identified by paleontologist Dr. Samuel P. Wells at the Kayantapas Hopi at University of California, Berkeley site V6898, east of Tuba Wells in 1971, which measured 40.6 centimeters, 16 inches long by 35.5 centimeters, 14 inches wide, and 132 centimeters, 52 inches, is the stride from heel to heel. Now, the only difference is they are larger than any dinosaur tracks we found at Tuba, but they're smaller than those found by Dr. R.S. Lull, the largest known here, which are 56 centimeters, 22 inches long, 35.5 centimeters, 14 inches wide, and a stride of 200 centimeters, 79 inches, the same size as a track cast from Tuba at California State University at Riverside's Museum, which is the track of an iguanodontid, which much too advanced according to evolution to be found in the early Jurassic at Tuba. Therefore, the Dehaney expedition's track has not been relocated. Dr. Hubbard states that when making the casts of dinosaur tracks, I found what looks exactly like a wolf track. Unfortunately, it was on the edge of the area containing the dinosaur tracks and was not accompanied by a succession of other wolf tracks, hence I cannot offer it as evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. In light of this, however, I predict that someday an area will be uncovered showing dinosaur tracks associated with mammal tracks. Hubbard, 1924, page 35. In 1969, Earl Cummings fulfilled his prediction when his plane had engine trouble and he was forced to land on a dirt road near Myankopi, Washington. While talking about the area, or walking rather, about the area, waiting for help to arrive, he spotted the clear fossil tracks of a barefoot child with toe prints about 20.3 centimeters, 8 inches long, in a trail of three prints followed by a trail of small three-toed dinosaur tracks, which were about 15.2 centimeters, or 6 inches long, as if the child was leading the dinosaur like a dog. But these tracks were headed north. Woodard, 1970, and Ross, now 1985, and Aldenay, 1990. Then in 1984, Lorraine Austin, a creationist speaker, passed through Tuba and never having heard of Hubbard's prediction or Cummings' discovery, she stopped at the famous Manavi Road dinosaur track site just off of Highway 160 west of Tuba City. The site is about 250 meters, that's 820 feet north on Manavi Road, and the site is a few meters from the road on your left, west of the road. Now there she saw human-like track impressions among the dinosaur tracks in an area that we now call Site Number 1. The Reverend Paul Rusnow heard about Austin's tracks and while passing through Tuba in 1984 from a Bible science conference at the Grand Canyon, stopped to look for the tracks. He was unable to find her tracks, but the Navajos showed him what they called caveman tracks. They were about 100 meters, 109 yards south, 45 degrees west of the main dinosaur track area, where the Navajo's jewelry sales sheds are near the road, and these, three of these, were marked by circles of stones looking about the area that he found other unmarked impressions. Then, in 1985, Paul Rusnow met Earl Cummings after a lecture that he'd given on the tracks at the Bible Science Conference at the Grand Canyon. Cummings told him about the tracks that he had found years before. Well, once again, on his way back to California, Rusnow stopped at Tuba City in 1986, and while searching for Cummings' tracks, found what we now call the classic print number 39. It is the best quasi-human ichthyofossil at Site 2. Thus, Site 2 was discovered about 3 kilometers from Site 1. Searching the area, he found what we call the downhill trail sighting track and many other less impressive track-like impressions. Now, on a recent trip, Rusnow talked to a Navajo at Site 2. F. Sellers, who told him about some wolf tracks with dinosaur tracks, and led him there, Rusnow saw a trail of about 25 or more rounded quadrupedal tracks on a trackway, which were obviously not reptile tracks, who walk tetraphytically on their belly. The impressions were not clear enough for identification, however, they were crossed by the unmistakable tracks of a galator, or a track name, made by the dinosaur Caelophus. And Rusnow's photographs of these side tracks, or trackways, are in our article in the Creation Research Society Quarterly, titled Rusnow, December 1989, page 79, pictures on page 96 and 97. Now, in 1984, Jeremy Aldenay, that's the author of this article, heard about the tracks that Rusnow had found and went to visit him to see the tracks. In 1985, while coming back from a trip to see the quasi-human ichnofossils in the Paluxy River in Texas, I stopped at Tuba, and while looking at the humanoid tracks with stone circles around them, discovered 4 more track-like features, and one was number 6, the best track at Site 1. It was a double print with 2 impressions of toes, and it was a trackway with 2 other same-sized prints, number 5 and number 4. Pictures of this impression are in our article. That's published by Rusnow in September 1989, page 45. Well, let me pause here and let me make an observation for you. I went down to Glen Rose, Texas. And down at Glen Rose, they've got dinosaur tracks with human tracks. Not one, but many of them. Tracks found in the same strata. So, those weren't discovered last week or last month. The first one was discovered back in 1910. Some guy had homesteaded that piece of real estate. And they found other artifacts. Now, what they're looking at, or what we're looking at in this day and age, is the results of Noah's flood. When the flood came, the dinosaurs and these people were fleeing to higher ground. These are survivors that hadn't been killed yet. They're going to get killed, but they're fleeing to higher ground, trying to survive another day. And the tracks, when they were made, got filled in and then hardened later, and they've been discovered. Now, I don't know how many of these tracks have been found. You can rest assured, as was the case up on the Columbia River. They found a skeleton up on the Columbia River, and it was not an Indian. It was a European. And they found it in strata that they dated, it was 9 to 13,000 years. So immediately the Indians jumped on it. I wonder why they jumped on it. And they said, well, we got to have that skeleton so we can bury it in our tribal graveyard. Now listen, when you discover a European skeleton that's in strata that you think is 9 to 13,000 years old, now it wasn't that old, but it certainly wasn't an Indian. And they took that evidence and destroyed it. Ladies and gentlemen, that's not science. That's a cover-up. That's not science. That's indoctrination. Europeans were here and they got buried long before Columbus ever thought about sailing west. Now, there's a series of books that are written by a fellow by the name of Collins, Stephen Collins, which identifies the Israelites and their travels. The Israelites, you know, the people from King David and then Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I'll give you the guy's name and number here and you can call him Stephen M. Collins. 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Now, his telephone number is 605-361-5069. This guy's written 4 books out of 6. He's going to write 6 on the migrations. He can trace them through the Bible, and he can trace them through secular history and identify the people in France as coming from Reuben, the people in Holland coming from Zebulun, the people in South Africa coming from Asher. He can identify all the lost tribes of Israel, does a hell of a job of it, documents it all. And you're not ever going to see a word of that in any anthropological paper, note, book, or review. They'll bury that so deep it'll never see the sight of day. And you're looking for the title of a book, The Lost Tribes of Israel Found, is the first book, I believe. Parthia, Scythia. There's 4 books. So send the guy a $100 bill telling you what his 4 books. He'll autograph them for you and send them to you. That'd be $25 a book. I forgot exactly what they are. You can also get them from his publisher, the book company. I don't remember who that is right now. But Stephen M. Collins is this guy's name, 605-361-5069 is his phone. You can call him and ask him, what do you want for these 4 books? Or 1 or 2 or 3 of them, as many as you want. My point is that a reader or a listener calls and he says, would you comment on this? And well, let me comment on it. So now I'm commenting on it. Now let me give you the sources of information so that you can satisfy yourself that old George over here isn't as crazy as you thought he was. Now remember I told you about Kent Hovind over here. Let me give you his name and number again. Kent Hovind, Creation Science Evangelism, 29 Cummings Road, Pensacola, Florida, 32503. Again, that's Dr. Kent Hovind, 29 Cummings Road, Pensacola, Florida, 32503. For $100, he's got 7 videotapes. Very well done, professionally done. And he's got a phone down there, too, if you want to call and ask him what the price is. It's 850-479-3466. Once more, that's 850-479-3466. And the third guy over here, who furnished me with the article and the books that I'm reading to you from now, is Carl Baugh, Creation Science Museum, Glen Rose, Texas. Just write Creation Science Museum, Glen Rose, Texas, and tell him you want the book. Or a phone number or something, Twin Cities Creation Conference. Don't think for a moment that there aren't creation scientists out there that write books and papers and periodicals. I mean, there's an underground press. There's information out here. There's all kinds of documentation for these facts, photographs and pictures and measurements. And the guys that are making these photographs and pictures are PhDs. You know, they've got letters after their name, just like these evolutionary scientists, you know, the so-called scientists that write papers and articles, you know, for the National Geographic. Now, let me give you a caveat here. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. So if you want a copy of today's program, it's on 32-bit CD quality. It's actually radio quality. Radio stations all over the world pick this program up. They take it right off of the Internet and broadcast it. You can do the same thing. You can just take it right off the Internet, and you can copy it on your own CD, send it to your friends. Or you can copy it, or you can go back and listen to the archives. If you're riding around in your car and you're listening to this program right now and you say, well, gee, I wonder if I could get this program again. Sure, just go to georgegordon.org. if you can remember that, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives. They're on there by title and date, and then you can just go down the list and pick out whatever stories you want to copy and whatever you want to do with them. And they're all free of charge. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. And you want to remember that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, why don't you go to my website, georgegordon.org, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email. It's a long email, 32 characters long. And then you don't have to write it out. Just click onto it and punch the button. And you can send an email and ask for that general law CD package. It's free of charge. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. This article here in the Creation Conference, they call this thing again the Creation Conference, the Twin Cities Creation Conference. It's called the Proceedings of the 1992 Twin Cities Creation Conference, sponsored by the Twin Cities Association, the Genesis Institute, and Northwestern College, assisted by the Creation Health Foundation. The guy that wrote this particular article in here is an update on human track-like features found with dinosaur tracks at Tuba City, Arizona, by Jeremy Aldenay. And scientists of all disciplines and persuasions are writing in this paper. They went to the conference and presented their latest findings on cyclotrons and physics in the light of creation science, in the light of the Bible. You probably never heard of anything like this. I hadn't either until I went down to Glen Rose, Texas. I didn't know that there was anybody out there that ever gave the time of day to the Bible. Well, there are, and there's thousands of them. Dr. Wernher von Braun was one of them. Many very eminent scientists believe in the Bible and special creation. It's just that they don't ever get published. If you're going to publish something in National Geographic, it's got to be evolutionary. You can't get anything like this published. But that doesn't mean that it isn't published and that you can't avail yourself of it. There's one more book. Let me give you this one. If you want to get a good handle on the Genesis flood, it's the best book I've ever seen. It's a college-level science textbook. It's a geology textbook, is what it is. It's a geology textbook, and it's written by a guy named Henry M. Morris. He's the professor and head of the Department of Civil Engineering. Or at least he was. I think he's still alive. I think I've heard the name Morris around. John C. Whitcomb was a theologian, professor of Old Testament, Grace Theological Seminary. This book was written. It's still in print. Last time I heard, they got new printings of it. I got the 65 model. This is a college-level textbook on geology written from the biblical point of view. And it'll tell you where the bodies are buried. It's called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. Just go to your local used bookstore and tell them you want a copy, and they'll get it. All right, now Aldenay goes on to say, then on a field trip in 1987, I discovered several new impressions at Site 2 and the place where it appears that a child fell, leaving a faint handprint next to a trackway. I discovered bones, teeth, and articulated clams at Site Number 1. In 1989, I discovered another track in high-angle light early in the morning, number 40, an identical mate to the classic print. Then on a trip in June 1990, I tried to rediscover the unidentified quadrupedal and dinosaur trackway about 1,830 meters, 2,000 yards, southwest of Site 2. Instead, I discovered some new tracks at a large carnosaur, or of a large carnosaur, with clawed three-toed prints, 28 centimeters, 11 inches long, 23 centimeters, 9 inches wide, and 114 centimeters, 45-inch stride. Then I found a small grallator track, 15 centimeters, 6 inches long. On October the 17th, 1990, on a field trip, October 15th, I made the great discovery of numerous dinosaur trackways, 50 meters, that's 166 feet north, 10 degrees west of the classic print at Site 2. These are clear, undisputed, small, and large carnosaur trackways, and this spot matches all of the clues Earl Cummings gave me to locate his child's prints. These tracks came in different sizes for each individual, 12.5 centimeter, 5 inches, 15.2 centimeter, 6 inches, 17.8 centimeters, 7 inches, and 33 centimeters, 13 inches long. The small tracks would be Grallator, and the large ones, Eubrontes giganteus, and was no doubt made by the Dilophosaur, which was identified with two type skeletons found in the same strata off of Monavi Road, northwest of the dinosaur track area at Site 1. That's published Wells 1970 and Wells 1984. I didn't find any human tracks, but these tracks are a match for the 15.2 centimeter, 6-inch, three-toed tracks in a flat, lying lair described by Cummings. Other evidence matched also, which I will not mention. This indicates Cummings' clear, barefoot human tracks are only about 15 meters or 50 feet from this spot and are still covered by loose sand and hidden from view. Now, the humanoid impressions documented at Tuba City. In our previous two reports in 1989, we recorded 53 quasi-human ichnofossils and identified them as numbers 1 to 53 in six areas, H1 through H4 and H6 through H7, at three different sites. Site 1, an area 1.8 kilometer northwest of Site 1, and Site 2, 3 kilometers from Site 1, all in cross-bedded aqueous sand dunes above and below from 30 to 183 centimeters or 1 to 6 feet, the famous Kayenta dinosaur track layer in flattening calciferous sandstone, which is called the Tadilto Formation by Gregory the Great Geologist, published Gregory, 1917. Here are new humanoid impressions discovered in 1990. When we located new tracks during our field trip June 21st to 27th, 1990, we gave them the same number as the closest previously identified and recorded impressions with a dash and a number starting with 1, or when they weren't near a recorded impression, we continued numbering them where we left off at number 53. All of these new features are found at Site 2, Area H6, classic print area, new impressions, and then it's got a list of numbers. Area 7, downhill trail, new impressions, and it's got a list of numbers. New trail between H6 and H7, and it's got new numbers. Area H7, unrecorded area west of downhill trail, new impressions, here's the numbers. And dinosaur-like features not in a trail, but similar and close together. And then there's some more numbers. So I guess if you wanted to go check this out and go look at these prints that are made by humans and dinosaurs at Tuba City, Arizona, this is the map that tells you how to get out there. Now, this kind of information is not lost on National Geographic or on the Chicago Museum of Natural History. Those guys all know about this. I mean, my God, this guy Gregory is writing clear back in 1917 when they were perpetrating this Piltdown Man hoax on us from 1912 to 1953. Here's this guy Gregory running around here saying, hey, listen, I got some human tracks and some dinosaur tracks in the same strata. And they were found down at Glen Rose, Texas. God only knows how many places that there are human and dinosaur tracks found together. But again, the science is buried under the propaganda. Now, the science speaks for itself, and the propaganda needs to be exposed. So again, you know, if you want a copy of this book, well, I'm sure you can get one, or one like it, from Glen Rose, Texas, Creation Science. They call that Creation Science Museum. I think he put the word evidences in here. Creation Science Evidences Museum, I think is what that's called. Anyway, just write Carl Baugh, Glen Rose, Texas, and the guy will get it. It's a little small town. All right, let's take a look at evidence against the human origin of the features. In our article, Rossnow, 1989, page 92, I listed all the reasons why these quasi-human features could be made by humans, and I gave all the reasons why they may not be tracks of any kind. Most of the evidence I gave against the impressions being made by humans still stands, except for evidence 3 and 4 found in my conclusions in the December 1989 article in the Creation Research Society Quarterly, where I said that the rounded mounds were not like the normal flat-lying fossil track strata, and there was no evidence that this was a track layer or surface at one time, as in the same cross-bedded sandstone mounds. Clear, three-toed dinosaur tracks identical to the tracks found at Site 1 are shown in a photograph from Colorado in the same Navajo formation as found at Site 2. This proves tracks are found in these mounds, published by Lockley in 1991, Plate 8. The other evidence against them being human tracks includes there is a lack of clear track detail. There's a lack of trackway repetition, where even in trackways, each track is a little different. And of course, there are a few cases of two track-like features which look identical, but there are never more than two. The quasi-human ichnofossils resemblance to the calcite and sandstone nodules and burrows in the same mounds. No human remains have been found in the Kayenta formation. This is not really evidence against, because the upper conglomerate bone layer may not have in situ fossils like tracks 3 meters, 10 feet below them at Site 1. And also, there are hundreds of dinosaur tracks compared to a few humanoid impressions. And despite their numbers, and since there are only two skeletons of the Dilophosaur track maker found, published in Wells in 1984, the chance of finding human bones is very remote. However, there is Moab man, found in the Morrison Formation, and if it has been misdated, as I believe it has, it is in the same Kayenta Formation. So here's evidence now for the human origin of the features. The trackways have characteristics of barefoot or shod feet throughout every trail or double prints. And the trackways and double prints always appear to face the same direction in relation to each other when this is possible to determine, which is most of the time, about 80%, and in reasonable distances apart. 3, there are sharp, shoe-like lines around the shod prints with flat bottoms, unlike a nodule. However, the same effect is also produced by spalling, that is, the erosion like an onion peel. However, spalling produces lined laminations in the side of the impression, unlike a pressed-in track. 4, the majority of impressions fit my foot, while other fit my shoes, toe, ankle, heel, some even have an arch. These prints are as good as tracks, accepted as genuinely human tracks at Oro Grande near Victorville, California, and exhibited as casts at the San Bernardino County Museum. My discovery of the area where Earl Cummings saw the barefoot trackway of a child followed by a small dinosaur on October 17, 1990, in the flat calciferous sandstone of the undisputed dinosaur track layer called the Kayenta track layer at Gregory's Tadilto Formation, no longer accepted, only 50 meters, 166 feet north, 10 degrees west of the classic print, the best track at our humanoid track site 2 on the mounds of the Kayenta Formation, which could also be considered the Wingate Formation because it's below the dinosaur track layer, a marker bed. And there is an argument whether to identify some formations as Wingate, Kayenta, or Navajo. The fact is, they're all one formation. New Scientific Evidence, number 7, by microanalysis that can tell the difference between a track and a nodule, or spalling, which will be revealed in our next article in the Creation Research Society Quarterly. So here's my scenario of what happened at Tuba City. The dinosaurs, and possibly man and other animals, were caught in a worldwide cataclysmic event which had caused the Earth to crack open, causing worldwide earthquakes, and as a result of the newly formed fault systems, and resulting in downthrusts, inclines, and upthrusts, anticlines, creating mountains out of basement igneous rocks and volcanic eruptions around the world, each from 5 to 50 times greater than the largest eruption in known history, like Krakatoa. The atmosphere was upset by geysers of steam, hot water, powdered rock, and gases, causing torrential rains, burying man's artifacts in the bottoms of valleys and under the oceans on the continental shelves. The oceans raced inland to meet fresh water from the collapsing atmospheric shield, the canopy, and mineralized hot volcanic water from the Earth's crust, causing limestone to form. Surviving people and animals fled to the rising ground and were trapped between the rising flood waters. The explosive volcanic eruptions on higher ground, worldwide fires broke out, creating a worldwide charcoal layer. These creatures left tracks between major flood impacts. The rock powder from volcanic rhyolite blanketed the tracks as the water rose. Then the remains of living things began to wash down from the highlands to form the conglomerate layers from the mudflows. After a few days, the area was completely submerged, and floating mats of trees slowly became waterlogged and settled to the bottom to form coal. The continental plates, being lighter than the oceanic basalt, began to rise, and also because of the greater volume of water in the oceans, the loss of pressure from loss of water inside the crust, the Earth had to rebalance itself, and after several months, highlands appeared. And you'll see this in Genesis 8, verse 5, and Isaiah 40, verse 12. I'm leaving out some of the citations here in my quotations, but the moral of the story is, from the creation point of view, the Bible story tells you what happened. Then when you go out here and you actually go dig it up, it supports it. You take a look at the Grand Canyon, what you're looking at there is Noah's flood. That's what that is. When you go over to Dinosaur National Park and you're looking in Utah and you're looking at those dinosaurs, you're looking at animals that were caught in the flood and buried suddenly. When you go up to Alaska and you dig a mammoth out of Alaska or Siberia that still has green food in its mouth that it hasn't chewed up, that's an animal that was killed suddenly. You know, every once in a while I shoot a cow here, you know, on the farm, or a bull. And I always stick a pan of alfalfa pellets out there for him, and they're eating away, and I shoot him between the eyes. And he falls on the ground, and he still has the alfalfa pellets in his mouth. Now, boys and girls, I have scientifically demonstrated that when you find green food, when you find leaves and grass in an animal's mouth, that sucker died quick. He didn't die over millions of years or slowly evolve over eons of time and then get buried there. He died quick, and he got buried quick, because if he hadn't got buried quick to fossilize, then he would have been eaten up by bacteria and he would have dissipated. Now, I've had animals out here on the ground and they die. You know, you've got a cow, she dies, and you find her down here in the creek bottom somewhere, or you find her on a side hill and she dies. You go back there 3 or 4 years and there isn't a trace of that animal left. The bones are gone. You know, the little animals come along, the big animals, and they eat them up first. The buzzards, you know, eat them, and the coyotes. And then they're decimated or dissipated by the bacteria. And then finally the little animals come along, you know, the coons and possums, and they eat the bones up, or they scatter the bones around. I'm just telling you from experience. If you're going to get a fossil, you got to kill that sucker and bury him quick. If you don't, 3 or 4 years from now, there won't be a trace of him left. So when you're looking at fossils, you're looking at Noah's flood. That's the bottom line. And of course, when we go to school, they teach us, oh no, that's not Noah's flood. That's millions of years. And then you see this continent slowly sank into the ocean. Excuse me, boys and girls, but when a continent is slowly sinking into the ocean, even a snail is going to move away. Up on the Wildcat, there are literally tens of thousands of shells in a great big pile and buried in gravel. It's the evidence of a sudden burying. They were buried, killed, right then and there. That's Noah's flood. That's why I think the flood was worldwide and not local, because of the geologic evidence around us. Go down to New Mexico and take a look at those buttes out there. And you look at the top of that butte, and all of those buttes have the same elevation. I mean, you're looking across there, too. You know, take off on 666 south out of Shiprock, or north, or anywhere out there, and go up toward Colorado or someplace. And you're going to find that those buttes over there are the islands that are left from the scouring of a humongous volume of water. I mean, just look at it and then picture Noah's flood. And then just look at that and picture the continent slowly sinking into the ocean. And then ask yourself, well, what makes more sense? And if you've ever been in a flood or seen the evidence of a flood, the floods that we see from rivers are just little microcosms of what you see out there on those vast stretches of New Mexico with all those buttes out there. And that material that came out of the Grand Canyon is all sitting out there on the floodplain going down into northern Gulf of Mexico. Now that's what you're looking at. Well, I'm out of time here, so we got to stop here. We'll be back and finish this up next time. And let me give you a reminder here. I gave you the caveat, didn't I? So don't blame these people that are broadcasting the program. You blame me for what I say on the program. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. There's the signal. Says time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.